Good morning. How are you? Good. I don't know if this is just my experience, but I used to lead campers here all the time. We did a whole bunch of winter camps, and I did a couple summer camps. Tell me if this is a little bit like your experience. Sunday, you get here, and it's all like, yeah, let's go. Let's get to work. Monday, you still got that same energy going. By Wednesday, you start to feel a little zombie-ish, especially now they've got these morning things. It's 7:30 a.m. But then by Friday, so like if you're like zombie-ish, like Walking Dead's part, in by Wednesday, you kind of do this switch by Friday where by Friday, you're like, if I hear one more piece of drama, I'm just going to Rick Grimes on everybody, right? That's how I felt every single time. It's just really exhausting. But camp is clearly worth it. That's why we do it every year, right? That's why we bring as many kids as we can. I loved coming up to camp, coming up to Hume Lake, and seeing the program, being part of the musical worship, the devotion time you get. But I gotta be honest with you, the thing I loved most about camp was the snack shop. The snack shop. Now, that seems a little weird, that it might be my very favorite thing, but let's be honest. We come to camp to get closer with God, to learn more things about God, and although the worship is great, the speakers are fantastic, hopefully this speaker is fantastic, but the reason we come up here is to get closer with God. And for me, the snack shop was that place. That's where I got closer to God. Because the snack shop helped me meet God more than any place because they sold something there. They sold the ice cream. And I don't know if anybody else is like this, but I have religious experiences with ice cream. I love ice cream. I like tons of different kinds of ice cream. But I especially love one particular kind of ice cream because I'm a purist. You start adding things to ice cream and you're kind of like making it less pure. You're starting to, like, why are there nuts in my ice cream? I don't understand. Caramel? I don't get that. Instead, I just love strawberry ice cream. I love fruit, so strawberry ice cream. How many strawberry ice cream lovers out there? Oh, there's a couple of you. Usually nobody says, they're like, you're weird. But I love strawberry ice cream. Now, who says something else is a better flavor of ice cream? Okay, sinners, I'm sorry. Jesus promised that the road was narrow, and I'm willing to walk that road. I'll pray for you. Sure, sometimes I try other flavors of ice cream because, I mean, people backslide, but every day, I thank Jesus for ice cream. And today, I want to have a conversation with you about truth and relativism and the culture we live in. And I'm going to do it using ice cream. I'm going to make two claims about ice cream. Here, the first claim is this. Strawberry ice cream is the best. Strawberry ice cream is the best. That's my first claim that I'm going to start with to show what relativism has done to our culture. Here's the second one. Ice cream is a medicine that helps control diabetes. Ice cream is a medicine that helps control diabetes. Now, this statement here is one that, as I say it, you may not agree with me, but everybody can go, cool, that's his. He likes strawberry ice cream a lot. In fact, maybe a little too much talking about it religiously. But this one, if we're going to say ice cream is a medicine that controls diabetes, really quickly, if I'm really going to try and convince you of that, you're going to be like, dude, I think you're wrong. In fact, if you try and give me, if you're a diabetic and you're like, if you try and give me ice cream instead, we're going to have some words. We might come to blows. No, that's because we know insulin is a medicine that helps control diabetes, right? Ice cream doesn't do that. Now, these two different claims are different types of claims. The first claim, actually, is what we call a subjective truth. It's a truth about me, the subject, making the claim. It's not really about the ice cream. It's about how I experience the ice cream, right? But the second one about insulin, that's what we call an objective truth. It's actually about the insulin. In the first part, it's about the ice cream. Ice cream doesn't help control diabetes. Insulin helps control diabetes. It's an objective truth. It's true for the thing itself. Are we following with me? Give me some nods. Okay, now I know you're the leaders at the camp, but it's now time for a test. All right, let's go through some statements, and I want you to tell me if this statement is a subjective statement or an objective statement. So your students are probably going back to school like next week or the week after, maybe at latest. Just tell them, well, you had a test before them when they start to whine about it, okay? I had a test at camp. So tell me if this is a subjective or an objective statement. So here's the first one. That guy's shirt is red. How many of you would say that's a subjective statement? Raise your hand. How many of you would say that's an objective statement? Raise your hand. Okay, that is an objective statement. It is a statement about the shirt, right? It is red. Now, if I said that guy's shirt is awesome, that's a preference statement about me, right? That'd be more subjective. All right, let's try number two. Red is the best color. How many of you would say subjective? Okay, how many of you would say objective? All right, we're doing really good here. The students, when I do this for students, they don't do as good, even right there. Three, 2 + 2 = 4. How many say that's subjective? Subjective, okay. Objective, good. Number four, tropical island vacations are the best kind. How many of you would say that's subjective? Okay, now you may agree as well. Yep, that's the best kind, that's what I like. But yeah, it's a subjective statement. This next one, maybe a little bit hard. Gabriel, me, can bench 350 pounds. Why did we laugh? That's sad. So how many of you would say that's subjective? I would like to. Well, and if I said Gabriel would like to bench 350 pounds or something like that, or thinks he can but he's way wrong, we might get into that. But this is an objective statement, right? I mean, if we went down, if Hume Lake had a, I don't know, do they have a fitness center or something? They have a fitness center. We could go down there and I could show you what's up right now. I could show you that's not something I can do. But it's an objective statement. Right now, it's objectively false. Does that make sense? All right, number six. Atoms consist of protons, neutrons, and electrons. How many of you would say that's subjective? Okay, objective? Good. Seven, God exists. How many of you would say subjective? Okay, objective? Okay. Eight, Jesus is the only way to God, and the way Jews think about him are wrong. Now, we could be saying a false statement, but that's not what we're asking about. We could be saying a false or true statement. What we want to know right now is this subjective or objective? So how many of you say this is subjective? Okay, how many of you say it's objective? Okay? Premarital sex is wrong. How many of you say that's subjective? Okay, how many of you say that's objective? Okay? And then lastly, it is wrong for women to have an elective abortion. Elective meaning they choose it for no other reason than convenience or their own idea rather than health or something like that. How many of you would say that's subjective? Okay, how many of you would say it's objective? Okay, now, being leaders, this is usually what we find. You guys do a little bit better than the students. But when we do this with students, what you find is once you get here, it's really confusing for them. It's really confusing for them. 7, 8, 9, and 10, they start going, I don't know. And most of them actually like raise their hand twice because they don't know what to do with it. But really, subjective statements are about your preferences. Objective statements are about reality outside of you, what's happening. And these statements are all objective statements. This is about reality. Now, it could be objectively false, like me benching 350, right? That's a possibility, but it's a statement about reality. And the same thing, these three are saying things about whether or not this is the way it really is. Not just if we like it or not. These are objective statements. Now, here's the thing. This is a really important thing to realize that our students are struggling with. Because the culture we live in pushes a worldview, a belief called relativism. Relativism is the idea that truth changes from person to person. Or subject to subject, to put it in the language we were just using. Relativism is the idea that truth changes depending on what we believe. In their book, Soul Searching, Christian Smith and Melinda Lundquist Denton did a huge study of the American teenager. And this came out probably 10 years ago now, maybe it was 12 or so years ago. And in it, they found that relativism was a huge part of everyday life for these students. And one of the things they wrote was this, and I think that this is a really important quote. American youth, like American adults, so he doesn't put us and say, oh, you don't have this problem. Like American adults are nearly without exception, profoundly individualistic. The American dream, right? Individualistic. The typical bywords are, who am I to judge? If that's what they choose, whatever. Each person decides for himself. And if it works for them, fine. If it works for them, fine. Some teenagers champion the skeptic's view of individual relativistic truth with great relish. Some version of this individual subjectivism and relativism is the dominant assumed viewpoint about religion among most contemporary U.S. adolescents. So in some way, this relativism, this, well, this is only for me, it's an individual thing, they can have their individual thing, is kind of the dominant view of religion. And as much as we know Christianity is a relationship, it's also religious. And so what we find is when we're telling our students, look, you need to give your life to Jesus. You need to live with him and all of these things. What they are hearing is, well, that's a really good thing for you. And it might be really good for me, but I don't really need to tell anybody else about it. I don't need to really worry about what's going on with them because truth changes from person to person. Now, if you think that I'm overblowing this, I have a clip for you. Do we have that sound ready? All right. You may have seen this.
There's been a lot of talk about identity lately, but how far does it go? And is it possible to be wrong? We went to the University of Washington to find out.
Are you aware of the debate happening in Washington State around the ability to access bathrooms, locker rooms, spas based on gender identity and gender expression?
I think people should be able to have access to the facility.
I think bathrooms could and potentially should be gender neutral because there doesn't need to be a classification for differences.
I think people definitely should have the ability to go into whichever locker room they want.
I feel like at least public universities should do their best to accommodate for those who do not have a specific gender identity.
You know, whether you identify as male or female and whether your sex at birth is matching to that, you should be able to utilize the resources.
So if I told you that I was a woman, what would your response be?
Good for you. Okay. Like, yeah.
Nice to meet you.
I'll be like, what? Really?
I don't have a problem with it.
I'd ask you how you came to that conclusion.
If I told you that I was Chinese, what would your response be?
I mean, I might be a little surprised, but I would say, good for you. Like, yeah, be who you are.
I would maybe think you had some Chinese ancestor.
I would ask you how you similarly came to that conclusion and why you came to that conclusion.
I would have a lot of questions, just because on the outside I would assume that you're a white man.
If I told you that I was 7 years old, what would your response be?
I wouldn't believe that immediately.
I probably wouldn't believe it, but I mean, it wouldn't really bother me that much to go out my way and tell you, no, you're wrong. I'd just be like, oh, okay, he wants to say he's 7 years old.
If you feel seven at heart, then then so be it. Yeah, good for you.
So if I wanted to enroll in a first grade class, do you think I should be allowed to?
Probably not, I guess. I mean, unless you haven't completed first grade up to this point and for some reason need to do that now.
If that's where you feel like mentally you should be, then I feel like there are communities that would accept you for that.
I would say so long as you're not hindering society and you're not causing harm to other people, I feel like that should be a okay thing.
If I told you I'm 6'5", what would you say?
That I would question.
Why?
Because you're not. No, I don't think you're 6'5".
If you truly believed you're 6'5", I don't think it's harmful. I think it's fine if you believe that. It doesn't matter to me if you think you're taller than you are.
So you'd be willing to tell me I'm wrong?
I wouldn't tell you you're wrong.
No, but I say that I don't think that you are.
I feel like that's not my place as like another human to say someone is wrong or to draw lines or boundaries.
No, I mean, I wouldn't just go like, oh, you're wrong. Like, that's wrong to believe in it. Because, I mean, again, it doesn't really bother me what you want to think about your height or anything.
So I can be a Chinese woman.
You. Sure.
But I can't be a 6'5" Chinese woman.
Yes.
If you thoroughly debated me or explained why you felt that you were 6'5", I feel like I would be very open to saying that you are 6'5", or Chinese, or a woman.
It shouldn't be hard to tell a 5'9 white guy that he's not a 6'5 Chinese woman. But clearly it is. Why? What does that say about our culture? And what does that say about our ability to answer the questions that actually are difficult?
So, that's in some ways a little humorous, but if you take a step back, I think it's really kind of scary. Why can't they say, look, you're not 6'5"? They all struggled with that. And I don't know if you heard it in there. Over and over again, people were saying, well, if it doesn't do any harm, and what we're going to find out is actually when you start having this idea that truth changes from person to person, very quickly it does become harmful. Very quickly it does become harmful because ideas have consequences. Ideas make the way people make their decisions. And so what you think about here does trickle into what you do over here. Our actions are not divorced from our beliefs. And so ideas have consequences. And this is going to be something that we delve into a little bit. Consequence number one, relativism undermines sin. The whole idea that sin is real comes from not a relativistic worldview. It comes from the idea that there are things that are right and there are things that are wrong. C.S. Lewis put it this way: it is after you have realized that there is a moral law and a power behind that law, and that you have broken the law and put yourself wrong with that power, it is after this, and not a moment sooner, that Christianity begins to talk. We want our students to know Jesus, but they don't see why they need a savior if they don't know they need saving from something. It's the idea, you don't know you need a shower unless you know you're dirty. So that's our first thing. Relativism undermines sin because they can do whatever's right for them, and I'll do whatever's right for me, and this person over here will do whatever's right for them. It's not hard to realize that someone says, well, you might be 6'5 Chinese woman, like in the clip, but over here, somebody goes, well, I don't think lying is wrong. I mean, because I think all of us in here would agree, there's these areas where, well, is it okay to lie to save someone's life? And all that makes it a harder question, but there's right answers, correct? Just like there's a right answer to the 6'5 Chinese woman question. And if that was hard, then this other one's going to be really hard. So that's consequence number one. Relativism undermines sin. Here's consequence number two. Relativism undermines mission. Jesus said, go into all the world. But if truth changes in all the world, between person to person, culture to culture, then what motivation is there to go tell someone they're wrong and that they need Jesus? What motivation is there to go to your neighbor down the street, let alone another continent? Relativism undermines mission. Consequence number three, relativism undermines justice. We think there are things that are really, really wrong. And because of that, we are to fight, maybe not actual physical fight, but we are to contend for justice. But relativism undermines that justice. And this is exactly what, I'm going to pull the Nazi card real quick here. The Nazis at the end of World War II said, well, we were just following our culture. And thank God the people at the Nuremberg trials said, that doesn't matter. Your culture was wrong. Because it was a justice issue. Relativism undermines justice. And then consequence number four, and there are probably more consequences than this, but it makes Christianity completely irrelevant. This whole idea of relativism comes from a view of the world that says that everything's part of a two-story house. We have our truths on the objective floor, our truths on the bottom floor that has access to the public, everybody has it. That stuff's like science or empirical, things you can touch, taste, see, feel, hear, those sorts of things. That's objective truth. That's stuff we all have access to. But when it comes to religion, put that upstairs and don't let people have access to that. That's just your truth. And we do that. We sit back and we say, yeah, this is just a subjective thing. This is just how I feel. I remember at one point I was trying to become a firefighter. I had gone through the academy, all these different things. And a friend of mine who went through the fire academy was running with me. He was not a Christian. We're talking as we're running because you got to stay in shape to be a good firefighter. He said something to the effect of, last night I got with this girl and all of that. And I was 22. And at that point I went, well, you know, me being a Christian, I'd never do that. But that's okay. Because I had bought into this relativism. I had bought into this relativism. Christianity becomes completely irrelevant in a world where it doesn't have something to say for everyone. In their book, Soul Searching, this is the way they put it. Religion is mostly situated in the background of everyday living. Their Christianity is situated in the background of everyday living. I got another clip for you. This one's a little bit shorter. We'll be done fairly soon, and you can go get as much coffee, because I'm sorry, I'm not in charge of the coffee. It didn't come today, or I don't know if it comes ever. But here's our a clip that explains.
There are evangelical teenagers who don't understand much about their faith and who are pretty, by their own tradition standards, pretty lame. Teens could be articulate, but when it came to their religious faith beliefs, most were totally at sea. They couldn't articulate hardly anything that they believed. Again, it just seemed to be something they took for granted. It was just in the background. And for some teenagers, our questions about, you know, what are your religious beliefs, seem to be the first time that any adult had ever asked them, what do you believe?
My name is Michaela Page. I am 16. I'm in the 10th grade, and I live in Nampa, Idaho. I grew up in the Nampa First Church of the Nazarene my whole entire life. I started from when I was a baby until now. I think I have a really good relationship with God. I pray with him every single morning on the way to school. I try to do my devotions every single day. It's really hard because, you know, it's your life. You have a job, you have school. Things, sometimes you get tired and you just want to go to bed. It's not like he requires, he just would like us to follow him, follow in his footsteps, do the right thing. But everybody's gonna make a mistake. But that's what the good thing about God is you can ask for forgiveness and he'll forgive you right then and there. I don't know. I get.
What do you think about
you? I think, I don't know. I don't really know.
I don't know about you, but that breaks my heart. What do you think about Jesus? The cornerstone, the rock, the very center of our faith. And she's like, I don't know. And some of that's our failure, right? As leaders and parents, it's our failure in saying we haven't really pushed religion. We want everybody to come to their own conclusions, and that's good. They should come to their own conclusions. But really, if we just leave them there, you let them, to borrow from people before me, just to be blown about by every wind and wave, right? And that's what happens, because this two-story house is a cage that has locked our faith away from the culture. faith is irrelevant. It's mostly situated in the background of everyday living. In other words, it doesn't inform everything you do. It only informs when you're in your devotion time. People, when we talk about this relativism thing, come up with objections all the time. So they say things like, there is no truth. All truth is relative. You know, truth is unknowable and nobody has it. How many of you have heard statements like this? Maybe even these exact statements. Now, being leaders, you probably know, a lot of you probably see right away, there's some problems with this. These all commit suicide. And this is a good tactic to know. The suicide tactic is a really important thing when you can evaluate statements for being self-refuting. All of those claims that we just saw are what are called self-refuting, or more technically, they're self-referentially absurd. When they refer to themselves, they become absurd. That's a really cool philosophical phrase to use maybe at dinner sometime. I'm sorry, that's self-referentially absurd. And everybody just kind of, wow, they're smart. But what we mean when we say that is that when you make that claim, it makes itself false. When you make a claim that is self-referentially absurd or commits suicide or is self-refuting, that makes itself false right from the very beginning. Here's some examples. How about all English sentences are false? Okay. That's English. So is that false or true? It makes itself a false statement just by uttering it. No sentences are longer than 6 words. If you need to count, go ahead. Okay, so it made itself false, right? Same thing, all bachelors love their wives. But a bachelor has no wife. Okay. My brother is an only child. And then Yogi Berra, he said, that place is so crowded, no one goes there anymore. That place is so crowded, no one goes there anymore. A lot of you might be in college or just got out of college. You probably saw this in textbooks. This page intentionally left blank. This page intentionally left blank. But what makes all of these statements commit suicide? What makes these statements commit suicide is something that you may already know, but you may not know exactly what it's called. It's called the law of non-contradiction. That's this: opposite ideas cannot both be true at the same time and in the same way. Opposite ideas cannot both be true at the same time and in the same way. So that just means what Avicenna, the medieval philosopher, said. He put this best, in my opinion, when he said, anyone who denies the law of non-contradiction should be beaten and burned until he admits that to be beaten is not the same as to not be beaten, and to be burned is not the same as not to be burned. The law of non-contradiction right there. So when you see there is no truth, or all truth is relative, truth is unknowable, nobody has the truth, these are all claims that commit suicide. There is no truth, is that true? All truth is relative, is that truth relative? So it's not all truth then. It's unknowable. How'd you know that one? Or if nobody has the truth, how'd you get it? You don't have it either. And this applies just as much to the realms of religion and morality. I say Jesus is the only way. I'm making a statement about reality. If I say a statement, a religious statement about reality that commits suicide, I've committed the suicide, or I've committed something that's self-referentially absurd just as much as any other realm. And this fits with the law of non-contradiction, and the law of non-contradiction works because of one other philosophical thought called the correspondence theory of truth. Now, this idea is not rocket scientists. This is the way your students really think most of the time until they start thinking about religion and morality. They really hold this correspondence theory of truth. The correspondence theory of truth just means that truth, things are true when a claim or idea matches up with the way the world really is. Matches up with reality. Truth is when a claim or idea matches up with reality. This is what we call the correspondence theory of truth, or the Comments view of truth, or the well, duh, theory of truth. It just means this, that if I say I weightlift, that's true if I actually weightlift, right? If I don't, then that's false. Or if I say my family is beautiful because they objectively are beautiful, it's true when it matches up with reality. That's all the correspondence theory of truth is. The first philosopher to really help us out, you may have heard of him, was Aristotle. He said, if you say that it is, and it is, or you say that it isn't, and it isn't, that's true. If you say that it isn't, and it is, or you say that it is, and it isn't, that's false. Wow. Thanks, Mr. Stottle. Really deep there. But the thing is sometimes we need philosophers to put into words what we should really know really easily. And I already know this is your view of truth and your students' view of truth. Why? Because when they cross the street, they look both ways to make sure a truck isn't coming. They check the harness when they do the high ropes course here to make sure they don't fall. You want to make sure that your belief or idea matches up with reality, that the harness is going to keep you from falling. That's the way truth works. And this agrees with the Bible. John 2:21, I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it, and because no lie is of the truth. That statement right there is saying there is a way the world really is. And lies are not that way. And this is a really important thing we need to continue to push on our students and not let them get away with the, well, that's just their truth. Or, well, I'm not going to tell them they're wrong if it doesn't harm anybody. What we've seen is that it really can end up harming people. And if you find in the next couple weeks or the next few days here, you're talking with students and you start to notice some of this relativism creeping into their conversation, let me urge you that truth is grounded in reality and you need to help them see that. Help them see that when it comes to the things that they do most of the time, they believe the correspondence theory of truth. But they've missed it when they say things like, well, God exists, but they don't have to believe that. Because truth is grounded in reality. And you're going to find as you look into this that more and more you're hearing that sort of thing creep into the conversation. But we are Christians because we believe Christianity is objectively true. That's what Jesus said, that it's true for everyone, whether they believe it or not. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And what's really interesting to remember about that statement was he wasn't excluding people. He was inviting, he was saying, please come to me because I am the way. He was saying, please come to me. Now, if you see that your students have a problem with this, or maybe you even feel, man, it's hard for me sometimes to get through this, I really urge you to go to the Rethink Conference in Orange County this September. I know of no better organization that works on these things than Stand to Reason. And their Rethink Conference equips leaders and students better than any other conference I've ever been to. They have an awesome lineup of speakers, some great breakout sessions. They get a fantastic band to play, and they will do a fantastic job equipping your students for the culture. They will do a fantastic job equipping your students for the culture. One more thing, and then we'll be done. This is really important, and here's why. Sometime this week, please go read 1 Corinthians 15. Please go read 1 Corinthians 15, especially 12 through 19. In that passage, Paul says, the resurrection needs to be real. It needs to be a real historical event. Because if it's not, he says, look, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, your faith is in vain. Your faith is worthless. You're still in your sins, and we are of all men most to be pitied. We need it to be true for our faith to be worth anything. Now, is that a reason to think that it's true? No. The reasons to think it's true is the evidence behind the resurrection and the work that he does in our lives. But it has to be objectively true that Jesus rose from the dead, or our faith is false. So let's work to make sure that our students, when we ask them, what does Jesus have to do with any of this? They don't say, I don't know. Because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through him. Let's pray. Almighty God, thank you for these leaders and their desire to pour into students' lives. I ask that you would just be with them and give them energy for the last few days of camp, that they would be attentive to their students' needs, that they would listen to you and just be in your word and be able to really push your word out of their life and into the lives around them. We ask these things in your son's name. Amen. Thanks a lot.